start if the CAP board wants to talk, Nancy and Paul. Hi, welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
If you could just state your name for the record.
Yeah. Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having the CAP board here to present our biennial budget. I don't know if that's too loud or if it's just right.
It's fine.
Let me know. I am Nancy Stark. I am an architect and executive secretary of the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. May I introduce Paul Mandel. Paul is the principal planner to the board and zoning administrator for the board. We're starting at a disadvantage here. We didn't hand out our agendas. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay.
I'd like to give you just a brief introduction to the CAP board and then also to go through our current biennial budget as well as the projections for 06-07. The CAP board was established by the 1967 legislature. It is a small independent planning and regulatory agency responsible for architectural design and long-range planning for the capital area. The legislature sets the CAP board boundary areas, and you can view those boundaries on a map just behind the agenda page. The board's mission is twofold: to preserve and enhance the dignity, beauty, and architectural integrity of the capital and the capital area's unique historic character. The second part of our mission is to help plan and guide the area's future development by maintaining a flexible framework for its physical growth. The CAP board has exclusive zoning jurisdiction and design review over both the state government complex and the surrounding commercial and residential neighborhoods. The agency guides this planning and design with a newly revised comprehensive plan and zoning and design rules for a 60-block area around Minnesota's Capitol building. The CAP board consists of 10 members chaired by the Lieutenant Governor and is composed of gubernatorial, mayoral, and legislative appointees. Three architectural planning professionals advise the board. The staff serving the board consists of four employees: an administrative assistant, a fiscal officer, a principal planner, Paul, as that, and also a zoning administrator, and myself as executive secretary. The board works closely with the Department of Administration and the Minnesota Historical Society on matters of policy, preservation of the Capitol building, and construction and maintenance of the Capitol Mall memorials. The CAP board's current biennium has been extremely abundant in work, with zoning request hearings, review and approval of three new state government buildings, emergency work to the Capitol's dome, roof, and third floor, four new memorials on the Capitol Mall in various stages of design, and providing full support of the chair and 14-member unfunded Capitol 2005 commission. The biennium has also been a time of great frustration for the staff and myself. Shortly after taking office, Governor Pawlenty reauthorized former Governor Ventura's executive order that created and established the 2005 commission, and in that same time frame cut the CAP board's 2004-05 budget by 20% for an already bare bones small state agency. Finance's recommendation to just get rid of someone was not a solution for the devastating reduction of the board's funding. Because of the known projected volume of work and the unknown demands of the 2005 Commission, I'd like to tell you about my dedicated, generous, and very creative staff. We work as a team, and we sat and made the decision to immediately go to work at 64-hour pay periods in hopes that we could raise the bar to 72-hour pay periods. But never have we been able to maintain a full-time open state office during this biennium. Classified as a small state agency, the CAP Board by Statute 15B could employ 5 FTEs. The board was forward-thinking in the year 2000 when an employee retired, and we then downsized from 5 to 4 employees. However, we now operate only with 3.3 FTEs. The impact of the board's limited $262,000 per year of 2004-05 funding has produced deficiencies in our service to the public and other state agencies. Our turnaround to inquiries has not been as timely as we are known for. We're not too proud of that. And our limited number of CAP Board meetings and advisors' reviews have compromised some project schedules. My employees and I pay out of pocket for training, conferences, mileage, parking, and some of our office supplies. And contrary to the recent reporting of Dewar to the Star and Trib, we have no funds for achievement awards. Required step increases and insurance adjustments passed on have only meant a reduction in our hours to be able to absorb. So, in conclusion, I would like to say the CAP Board, as a small state agency, did not have the ability to absorb a 20% reduction in funding and take on the added support for an unfunded commission larger than the existing CAP Board. I believe my three employees should be commended for their volunteerism. The governor's recommendation for the CAP Board's funding to remain at $262,000 per year of the new biennium is a hold harmless position for the agency. However, the assumption that an agency can just absorb unfunded work and continue to operate with no provision for inflation or passed on expenses is not a position that a small, and I'll repeat, small state agency, unlike a large state agency, can easily accommodate. The Department of Finance's cost projections for the CAP Board, along with the Board's future expenses of needed updates to our zoning rules, our continued Capital 2005 Commission support, and charges for rent and land services will most assuredly force the Board into a part-time operation of 64-hour pay periods again. Therefore, I am now asking you to restore the Board's funding to our original base budget of $327,000 per year of the biennium as was established prior to FY 2004. The difference between $262,000 and $327,000 being $65,000. Thus, you will be returning the CAP Board to a state agency of full operation and service. And I thank you, Madam Chair, and Paul and I are ready for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Did you want to speak to Mr. Mandel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I would add, there is language, and I believe the governor's bill, as it's being introduced, has some language, both with regard in specific to our statute and another piece in general for all state employees, all state agencies. The first one, back in, for the past two bienniums, K-12 and this was started by Representative Krinke. As things started getting tight, back in 93, we were permitted to charge for extraordinary amounts of work when, for instance, the state buildings that are now being built on the campus require our attention to such a level that other parts of our work would suffer disastrously. So it allowed us to charge those public bodies. This would be the case for transportation planning in the district, new buildings, public agencies, et cetera, for the extraordinary level of service. And for the past two biennials, we've been permitted to retain those in our fund rather than returning them to the general fund. So there's language, and the governor and Department of Finance are in agreement with this, that in our bill for our language in particular, that would allow that for this next biennium through 2007, and that would be critical. Then in general, on addressing voluntary unpaid leave of absence, that would permit us, I mean, what we've been doing, the number of hours we've been reduced, would not normally be allowed under state law. The last biennium, the governor passed, or the governor's bill, and the legislature approved, you could go upwards of half time and still retain benefits. And I believe that's going to be in the governor's bill as it's come out, as being introduced. Otherwise, what we're doing wouldn't be possible at all. And we wouldn't have the benefits. So, I mean, there's a difference of between something like a few hundred hours and upwards of half time. And that would apply to all state agencies. I don't know how many agencies used it, but we wouldn't be existing today if we hadn't had that provision.
Okay. I have one question for you. I'm not sure who it's for. And it has to do with the article that was passed out.
The article?
The Humphrey Memorial.
Oh.
I was just curious. It said that the state has set aside $400,000 for the Humphrey Memorial, and I was just curious if that money had already been set aside, if it's already been paid for, or what, if not, what budget that is scheduled to come out of.
Madam Chair, I'll let Paul answer that as he's project manager for that memorial.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I can address this. This started back in 1993 with it was an appropriation in 1993. It was a non-bonding year, and it actually is the reason some of our numbers in your books show up like they're being inflated or like we have extra funds. There was roughly $150,000 in 1993 that was appropriated for a Humphrey Memorial on the Capitol grounds for our work to be design and site clarification. And then I believe it was either 99, I believe it was 1999. In the 93 legislation, there was a match required for a portion of that money. I think it was $82,000 that had to be matched, evenly matched by private sector dollars. In 1999, they had not progressed anywhere. We had a site, we had chosen a central water feature that was in our long-range mall plan for the lower mall. They hadn't secured any necessary funds, and there was another legislation, I believe, again, in 99, in non-bonding, adding $250,000 and removing the requirement for the match. So that brings it to roughly $400,000 of that. We've used maybe $12,000 to $15,000 to the planning so far, and we've just shortlisted for a set of, as a result of this, we've just shortlisted for some design teams to come back with proposals for that. The client group, which represents the family and friends of the Humphrey family, are looking to raise between $100,000 and $200,000 in private dollars before the project advances into construction.
Okay, so maybe I'm confused here. So in 1993, $150,000 was
correct,
appropriated at the time?
Correct.
And then in 1999, an additional $250,000?
An additional $250,000.
So you're not asking for anything additional in this biennium for the project?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And if I could make the point, we never advocate for memorials or advocate against them. The board is responsible for judging whether they're appropriate for the Capitol grounds. In this case, I mean, they always come from somewhere else, like the Vietnam Memorial, the Korean, always rose up through the...
Sure, I'm a new member, so I was just kind of curious about it.
Yeah.
Right. Do I have any questions from members of the CAP board?
Sure.
Representative Solberg.
Sir, just a curiosity. In the buildings of the retirement plans, CRA, BRA building on an F in the railroad park, if for lack of a better, on the north side of Pennsylvania Avenue. Those buildings are almost of the type of construction that we would normally see on the Capboard area, but they're not in the Capboard area. Was your agency involved in the design or approval of any of those buildings?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg.
Mr. Mandel.
We did not have any kind of a supervisory role in that, because Representative Solberg says, it is outside the boundaries. At the time, I know that they had, the responsible parties had looked to the same architect that had done the revenue building and had stated a preference for something of that class because of its proximity to the Capitol, and it is on a view corridor to the Capitol. I mean, you can see it over the hill type thing, or you can see the Capitol from it. We were consulted only for matters of questions of technical issues and such like that. But there is statute that calls for the City of St. Paul to assure that those areas immediately outside the boundaries of the Capitol area are designed in a manner that is compatible with the mission of the Capitol Area Planning Board, so that it fits our comp plan. And this allows us to, when we're working with the city, for instance, on the downtown areas, while we don't have jurisdiction, legislative or authority to control, we do get consulted with on those matters. So we were in discussion, but we had no authority to dictate that design.
Madam Chair, just one other thing. When the businesses or the City of St. Paul ask for your services on a consultant basis, do you then have a bill back charge for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, we can. On certain matters, like I serve on the adjunct team for the Design Center for St. Paul, and we do that just as a means of cooperating with the City of St. Paul on a consultative basis. But if we get involved in any extensive review, or if we incur costs, if they have to come to the CAC board for any kind of variances or board meetings or services of architectural advisors, we do charge them at cost for our services.
And Madam Chair, just one other question. Maybe the fiscal staff can answer this. In previous bienniums, there was at least an attempt from the governor's office to protect what we call small agencies from major cuts. The Council of Black and Latino, those type of very, very small agencies. Did this agency not qualify for those small cuts or did the other agencies take the small cuts as well?
Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, in the 2003 session, the CAC board was cut 20%, and it would qualify as a small agency. I believe in the State Government Finance Committee, every agency and board, except for the very, very small veteran service organizations, took at least, I think the minimum cut was a 5% cut and on up. So there were not any boards or small agencies other than those small veteran service boards that were protected from cuts in this committee. I don't know how that applies in other committees, but I could probably find out.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that.
I just want to interrupt. We now have a quorum, so I officially call the meeting to order at 8:42. Do you, Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Stark, if no adjustment is made to the recommended budget for the CAP board, what will the consequences be? What are we going to not see happen that is presumed to happen?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I think,
Ms. Stark,
as I pointed out, we know that our workload going into 2006-07 is going to be a continuum of many of the projects that I did outline for you, and we are continuing our support for the 2005 Commission. Right now, what finance is projecting for our costs, I would end up with about $11,000 to $10,000 of an operating budget. And in order to do that, I will have to take my staff down to 64-hour pay periods. In other words, we will not have an open state office. We'll be working part-time. At this point in time, with the volume of work that we have and the things that we need to do that we put aside because of the support for the 2005 Commission, we have zoning rules that we need to update. We have a comprehensive plan for the capital area that we need to update. These things have been put aside. So our volume of work is not decreasing, but the money will not allow us to continue with some of these projects as we would if we were on a full-time basis.
Mr. Mandel?
Madam Chair and Representative Hilty, the other unknown quantities is we don't yet know what our rent or our land service charge is going to be, and everyone's in that situation, but what Nancy is talking about are all based on assuming that those are remain the same.
Our current, Madam Chair, our current budget breaks down to about 82% for the salaries and a little over 7% for land and operating charges. So you can see, and the rest of it goes to rent. We are at a bare bottom figure right now. It costs us approximately $1,000 to conduct a CAP board meeting. It costs us probably $500 to $700 to conduct a 2005 commission meeting. The commission meets on a monthly basis. That's been an extreme drain. So if we have more commission meetings, we fluctuate between 72 and 64-hour pay periods. And I would note that this is an unfunded commission.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps a question for Mr. Mandel. I'm looking at the handout here for your request, and I see that there's about a $65,000 discrepancy, it looks like, between what the governor has recommended and what you are here to ask for today. And you touched on it a little bit, but I'm wondering about the discrepancy here. I imagine that you've had some conversations with the governor's office before putting together these requests, and I'm wondering if you can share with me the tenor of those conversations or exactly why did we have a discrepancy here between the governor's recommendation and your request here today.
Madam Chair, I will try to acknowledge that. We were asked by finance last fall to put together what we call a 20-60-20 plan. This was how were we going to operate in 06-07 with the continuum of the 04-05 biennial budget, the $262,000. And we reported to finance at that time we would be still a part-time open state agency, that with the volume of work that we had, we just would not be able to be open on a full-time basis. A 20% cut for us, who was already a very bare bones, was a drastic measure, even for a small agency, and specific for a small agency. We have not had discussion with the governor's office on this, on what we are asking for. What we're asking for returns us to where we were before the major budget cut. That's why there is the discrepancy.
Mr. De La Forest? Representative De La Forest.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up question. So is it the fact then that the I'm trying to get a feel, and perhaps you're not the right person to ask. Maybe I should ask the governor's office directly, but is it a discrepancy here in that there's a disagreement as to the amount of money needed to operate your agency on a part-time basis, or is that the governor's office doesn't feels that part-time is where you should be and you think that that's more? I'm just curious, did the governor's office give you a rationale or did you just never hear back regarding your request at 327?
Madam Chair, I cannot speak for the governor's office.
Madam Chair, as far as we can tell, what they took was they took the 04-05 level and just continued figuring there are no further cuts, and because they were hearing us at least that we can't go any further, but to have no further cuts and yet no further increases when health care is going to be going up in our, and we already know that the governor's got the supplemental numbers for personnel, et cetera, that it's still, I mean, it costs us more, so in order to make more, you have to work less. And it's, so it means even fewer hours. I mean, it could be 64, it could be even fewer hours.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Okay. I don't know about the reasons for the discrepancy, but that troubles me that there appears to be a lack of communication for whatever reason regarding something as fundamental as the budget request over the biennium. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Khan?
Madam Chairman and members, and I think as we put our full budget together, I think this shows the bad arithmetic in doing across-the-board cuts for all agencies, irregardless of size. When you have a very tiny agency, there's obviously no flexibility. And there is, I happen to think, as many people do, that this is a very important function. It was set up because of, really bad things that were kind of happening to the Capitol complex with the urging of the city of St. Paul. And I think that when we put our final budget together, we can't really take this even-handed approach to all agencies. I think we have to understand that a cut to a really small agency that has no flexibility is much more devastating than a cut to a very large agency who can just, go slow in filling opening positions and make it up.
Thank you. I just want to clarify, it's not a cut this year. It's staying at the same level as last year is what the governor is proposing?
Yes, Madam Chair.
You're asking for an increase.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Mr. Mandel?
Madam Chair, we will leave a copy of our latest biennial report along with the talking points that start this delivery.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, next we have the Department of Revenue back again. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Salamone and Mr. Erno. You can begin your testimony, and I guess we'll take questions as they come.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name, for the record, is Dan Salamone. I'm Commissioner of Revenue. Madam Chair, I'd like to apologize for my inability to be here at your last meeting at which Deputy Commissioner Dennis Erno presented the information about the department. I was tied up in a rather large meeting regarding the utility valuation rules and something that had been scheduled for a long time. Later in the morning, I was at a press conference on truth and taxation, so it was a rather difficult morning. Pleased to be here. Thank you for the opportunity for us to share with you information about our budget and answer any questions you have about it. I think Dennis Scott had gotten into the presentation last time, and we're obviously here at the will of the committee, and I would suggest he continue where he left off, and I'd be happy to jump in and answer questions and elaborate if that's necessary. I will tell you that I've been commissioner for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with the department. I think we have our act together. It's a very mature department. There are pluses and minuses to that. In about 8 years or so, we're going to lose a good share of our top management team and other experts in the department because of simply the demographics. It's a real issue for us. But generally, I think we're in pretty good shape and look forward to working with the committee. With that, I guess I would invite Dennis to pick up where he left off in the slide presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold.
Madam Chair, committee members, in your packets from last week is a handout from the Department of Revenue. And it looks like this. If those are not in your packet, we do have additional copies to my immediate left here at the end of the table. But I'd like you to follow along with those slides. We were on page 4 of the packet, and we were on page 4 we were on the bottom left-hand slide. And what we were showing here is the Department of Revenue's biannual budget without any additional tax compliance enforcement initiatives being added to it. And what this illustrates is, one, that the department's budget has not been reduced for direct compliance activities or tax enforcement activities. In both the last biennium as well as in the budget recommendations for this biennium, that portion of the budget is being held constant in order to protect the state's bottom line so we don't lose any revenues as a result of the performance of all of those tax compliance activities, which includes tax auditing and collection of delinquent taxes as well as criminal investigations. So that part is being held constant. What is being cut and what has been being cut substantially in the department's budget is all of the support activities that basically really support compliance. That would be our tax processing of transactions, the recording of payments, the issuing of refunds, all of our technology to support electronic filing and paying systems. But it's all those kinds of compliance support activities that have been cut, and you can see that they've been cut from 2002 to 2004 by about approximately $19 million, and then from 2004-05 to 2006 by about $6 million. So the department has been really, the department's budget has been bifurcated into two components, those that perform direct compliance activities and those that don't. And we've been had cuts similar to what other agencies are in those compliance support activities.
Madam Chair.
Sometimes that's easy to miss when you look at our bottom line. Right. Now, that's without tax enforcement activities.
Okay. Representative Solberg, did
Madam
you want
to? When you do the support cuts, does that mean that my constituents get their refund later?
Mr. Arno?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, no. Because we've had some cost reduction strategies to cope with those budget cuts. Our principal strategy is to move away from paper to electronic transactions. A paper transaction costs us approximately $3. Electronic transaction costs about $1.25, and we're even moving that cost down less as we move to more and more electronic transactions. We now, 63% of our income tax returns, and we're a leader in the nation in that 63% of our income tax returns are filed electronically, 98% of our business tax returns are filed electronically. Our payments of transactions, over $10 billion now, about 73% comes in electronically. So that's one cost-making strategy. The other cost-making, and what it's been able to do, what we've been able to do now, is get electronic refunds out within 2 to 3 days. Normally, a refund check is in a person's bank if they file electronically before they even check with the bank. If they file the return on Friday, it's usually in the bank on Monday. For paper transactions, except for those that are filed near April 15th, we are getting those out today in approximately 14 days. And again, that's by adopting new technology. We scan the return when it comes right away. We get rid of the paper. There's no paper storage anymore in the Department of Revenue for income tax returns. You won't find them anywhere. They freed up a lot of space. They freed up a lot of positions in which were just retrieving information and not adding values. So we've been able to really focus in on providing the types of services that really add value and that are a part of our core competencies. That's meant better service for your constituencies in terms of faster refunds, even if they file by paper.
Representative Solberg?
As you are reducing the operations support, give me Give me just one instance of what job is going to be eliminated.
What job's going to be eliminated?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, those would be a lot of data entry jobs and file positions where you were actually retrieving paper from files and providing that paper to someone else. Or it might be somebody on a telephone that basically receives a call and then has to go on the computer and retrieve the information and give it to the taxpayer. We've moved away from some of that by developing self-service systems where taxpayers can now serve themselves either through information over the automated telephone systems or through self-service systems on the computer. Let me give you an example. After the individual income tax returns are filed, virtually half of our calls, and that's about 250,000 calls, 300,000 calls, are simply questions about where is my refund check? When am I going to get my refund check? We developed two strategies to basically cope with that. One, you can now get that information online yourself and track the progress of your refund. And two, we get it out of the door a lot faster. And by getting it out of the door faster, it eliminates those questions, and it also provides a service to taxpayers in that it diminishes the need for them to get these rapid refund loans and become victims of that because their refund check comes in almost instantaneously, at least from the state of Minnesota.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ernle, I just had a question. It appears to me from your testimony that electronic filing, and it seems intuitive to me, realizes a cost savings to your agency. But am I right in seeing somewhere that you charge taxpayers, however, to file? Let me back that up. I'm talking about individual filers. Do they have to pay a fee to file electronically?
Mr. Chairman, Representative DeForest.
Mr. Ernle.
DeForest. Sorry.
Yeah.
Della Forest. I'm sorry.
That works.
Whether a fee is charged, that is up to the tax preparer. We know from our studies that it probably costs less than a dollar to file electronically.
Okay.
However, tax preparers can charge whatever they do. It's a competitive market, and the rates are really set in that market. And they can do some cost shifting between what it costs to file the actual return and the fee to electronically file. So,
Madam Chair, Mr. Ernle, I haven't done with taxes yet. I'll just lay my cards on the table, my state taxes yet. So if I were to file electronically, though, you know, I do my own taxes rightly or wrongly, that wouldn't cost me to file electronically. There wouldn't be an additional fee to file electronically for me?
To my knowledge, if there was, it would be less than a dollar. Jerry McClure from our Individual Income Tax Division works with the software companies as well as electronic filing, and maybe you can answer that a little bit more directly. Jerry?
My name is Jerry McClure. I'm the Director of Income Tax for the Department of Revenue. Actually, Madam Chair, Representative, there are various software packages where the fees range. A number of packages are available for free depending on your income level or age. The cheapest fee that I'm aware of is $5.95 for filing your state return, free for the federal.
Okay.
And it goes up from there.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, and a question for the witness then. So fees might be charged through, say, well, TurboTax, for example, which is a popular example, if they charge a fee to file electronically, that's something that's decided solely by that private corporation. And it sounds to me like they're copying a significant amount of profit in some cases, mm-hmm. perhaps. No comment.
That's true.
Madam Chair, if I may add one other question that's unrelated and maybe more of a tax question, but I think ties into the state government finance piece, Commissioner Salamone, and that is issues, for example, non-compliance. I know that, for example, there will be debate, for example, about fixing the standard deduction, the discrepancy between state and federal, and I think it's about a $74 million
yes.
price tag. My question for you in this committee today, you know, the farther we get out of non-compliance with the federal tax code, does that impact your organization? For example, are there costs? Does it require more staff time then to look at returns? Are there more errors? Are there more phone calls from people who are confused about the differences between state and federal? I mean, essentially what my question is in a nutshell, do noncompliance issues result in operational costs to your organization? And if so, in what way? Is there a way you can quantify it or anecdotally?
Madam Chair, Representative De La Forest, I'm sure there is cost. I don't know that we have been able to quantify it. Obviously, to the extent that we don't stay in step with the federal system, and there may be good policy reasons why we might not want to, or budget reasons in this case, in the case of this year, that as we get out of step with the feds, the tax form becomes more complicated. We have to add more lines potentially on the form, more instructions, more off-the-form kind of calculations, the potential for confusion on the part of taxpayers who aren't electronically filing is greater. We so far have been able to work with our software vendors to incorporate the nonconformity into their programs, and that becomes a bigger challenge as we get more of that, particularly if we get late decisions on conformity or lack of conformity. Maybe Dennis can share more on whatever attempts in the past have been made to put a dollar figure on lack of conformity, but it would pale in comparison, at least in the current budget, to the cost of getting into step with all of what the feds did to us. Fact of the matter is the feds don't think a lot about the states when they do federal tax reform, and I hope they are getting the message as they contemplate rebuilding the whole federal system.
Right, and it seems to me, Madam Chair, and Mr. Ernol as well, that it probably accounts, I don't know for what share, but I'm sure it accounts for a share of the gap in non-compliance costs as well, is that you have folks out there who, in a good faith effort to do their taxes, simply don't know that because of differences between the federal and state code that they owe money to the state.
Madam Chair, Representative, when you asked your question, you were basically were right on in terms of your observations that were embedded in that question, and that is this: the minute we're out of conformity, the more we're out of conformity, the more differences we have from the federal. Number one, we see a dramatic increases in our phone calls. We can see that with any law, even with any law changes, a dramatic increase in our phone calls for that year. And then as we process the returns, we see a spike in the errors or discrepancies that are on the return. And of course, those have to be corrected. The taxpayer has to be contacted, the information secured and resolved before the return can be processed. So, yes, our costs do go up dramatically. Compliance goes down with the more discrepancies we have between the federal and the state.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Hopefully something to think about as we craft the budget mm-hmm. here in the legislature.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman and Commissioners, do you ever calculate in your budget what you lose in interest by getting the returns out faster?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, no.
Why not?
First of all, it's a philosophy and it's a value with us. It's the taxpayers' money. And basically, we've been holding it, and they're entitled to get it as quickly.
So you hold it in an account that doesn't bear interest?
Well, that's the Department of Finance. We don't have any control over the money. What we do have control over is how fast we process a refund. And just by the nature of electronic transaction, those can be accomplished overnight. And matter of fact, that's a strong incentive for people to file electronically. We think we owe the same kind of service. We shouldn't penalize paper people that file by paper, by holding out their refunds longer. Matter of fact, those are precisely the group that probably needs that refund faster than people who file electronically.
Well, Representative Kahn?
Madam Chairman, my question was not, should you hold them out longer to have a larger number? Was that number ever computed in the budget? Was that number ever listed anywhere in the budget? And if not, why not?
Commissioner Arno?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't know. That would be a question that would have to be addressed to the Department of Finance.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner Solomon.
Representative Kahn, what I'm hearing is you're wondering whether there should be identified, for potentially the sake of a budget offset, the savings from not paying the interest. And we apparently have never made the calculation. I would think it would be relatively insignificant given the fact that I don't know that the interest that we collect on the absence of faster refunds would be very significant. We can certainly look into that.
Yeah, I was just interested in what...
Yeah.
Also, Madam Chairman and Commissioner, sometime long ago when you were wearing a different hat, and so you may not remember this conversation or you may wish to deny it, which I guess you have either choice. In a meeting with you and my committee administrator at a time where I think we were trying to get you interested in looking at pension issues and the, because you had a broader view than just revenue and looking at pension plan inadequacies, as we saw. I think we got you personally interested in it, but we didn't get your group interested in it. But at that time, we were talking about property tax issues and the fact that the state property tax is set up so that about 90% of it is collected on a non-income-dependent level and about 10% is income-dependent. That would be the circuit breaker and the renter's credit. And you said at the time that I don't think you quite said that ratio should be reversed, but you said we should move towards adjusting that ratio so that it was closer to even, or, you know, maybe you even had the philosophy that that ratio should be reversed. But what do you think about that now, and is there any way we could move to doing something like that?
Commissioner Salamone?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I recall many conversations with you on various subjects. I thought actually you were going another place with that question with regard to the reform of the pension system. We did a report at the association about that. But the 90-10 split, if that's what it is, I don't recall the number, between the proportion of people who pay the property tax and don't get a circuit breaker offset and those who get that offset. And that offset varies by income class. I've always maintained that when it came to subsidizing taxpayers, that the tool of choice was the circuit breaker because it means tested. And I always maintained that if you had the money to subsidize property taxpayers, you ought to funnel it first as much as possible through the circuit breaker and less, and this is the part you might not agree with, less to the institutions of government, the local governments, that it subsidized the consumer, not the producer of the service. And we do both, and I think we could do more through the circuit breaker if we could reduce the dependence of local government on local aid, which is not an easy thing to do, as you well know.
Yes. Well, the problem is I didn't see in plans. All I see is the reduction. First of all, I hope you're not totally eliminating renter's credit, because...
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, no, we are actually...
Okay.
Defending the current
formula. No, I mean, when you just said you only talked about the circuit breaker, you didn't talk about renter's credit.
Well, I sort of lumped the two together, but they are clearly distinctly different, and
okay,
we are adjusting the amount. The governor proposes to adjust downward the percent of property tax assumed to be rent in the calculation of the renter credit.
Okay. Well,
and we have data to support that proposal.
Well, I think the problem is that we're what we see from the administration is we see suggestions to cut down local government aid, but we don't see the opposite then, which would go in with your philosophy, to increase then the income dependent part of the property tax by going to circuit breaker and renter's credit. And I think if the two were lumped, some of us, at least, maybe not the local units of government, but some of us might find that that's more acceptable.
Representative Kahn, Mr. Salamone, I'll let you answer that, but let's try to get back on task here. If you don't mind, we do have some more.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, very quick answer. I'm sure if we had a surplus, we might be talking about that. When you're talking about having to make severe budget cuts, as we did in 2003, and now less severe, but still a need to cut budget, cut expenditures, it's difficult to do all the things you might like to do. It's just a matter of priority. So the aid cuts were there and we didn't have the luxury of funneling some of that savings into the circuit breaker.
Well, then to follow up on the chair's admonition and get back on task, is there something within the department, the mechanism that could make the renter's credit more friendly? Maybe it's been made. I continually hear.
Representative Kahn, I'm not sure that this is the.
It is
the time for this conversation.
It's the operations of the department. What else? Where else do you do that?
Well, I'd like to have them finish going through the presentation and hear more about the task at hand. But
well, let's just put that question.
If we could maybe address that at a different time.
Madam Chair, I'll note the question. Maybe we can have a.
Thank you. Let's move on. Representative Solberg, do you have a question?
Not be admonished by the chair. I'll pass.
Okay, do you want to...
Madam Chair, just one thing. I'm deeply concerned also with the lack of federal conformity. I don't care. I've been around here many, many years and served under many governors. And one of the goals of every governor, no matter what political party they've been on, is to have federal conformity. And I think this is the first time I'm ever getting calls from individuals, tax preparers, and everything else, ever complaining about federal conformity. So I guess I would express my displeasure in the governor's not allowing the income tax cut be passed on that Bush has supposedly given to everybody.
Okay. Did you want to go on with the comment, or do you want to go on with the presentation?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll...
Commissioner Erno?
Solberg, I'll only add that as a tax administrator... I'm with you in spirit, as are my fellow tax administrator. We love simplicity and conformity, but these are tough times, and that was a tough pill to swallow that Feds gave us.
Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Salamoy, according to the President, the Feds gave us a tax cut, but we aren't all Minnesota residents aren't experiencing that same.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the Feds have one chief advantage in that they don't have to balance their budget.
Well, all you have to do is look at the administration, and you're right on that, that's for sure.
The playing field is not level, that's for sure.
All right, did you want to go on with your presentation, Mr. Erno?
Madam Chair, we will switch to page 5, the top slide. And this basically shows the Department of Revenue's biannual budget with tax compliance initiatives added in. And it also shows on the bottom line the revenue either actual or targeted that is to be generated as a result of those stepped up enforcement activities. On the bottom of page 5, you can see as a result of the budget cuts in our compliance support activities and as a result of funding for complex finances, how it's rearranged the department's budget. For 2000 to 2001 biennium, about 52% of our budget was made up of compliance support services, and 48% was made up of direct compliance activities. Again, that's auditing and tax collections. That's dramatically changed now over the course of the last three bienniums, and now 36% of our budget is made up of compliance support activities, and 64% is made up of direct enforcement activities.
Mm-hmm.
And again, part of that transition was made possible by shifting away from paper to electronic transactions and developing self-service systems where people can access the information on the web. For example, we have over 11 million visits to our web per year and about 8 million downloads of actually tax forms. Those were tax forms where we had to take the request over the phone before, put it in an envelope, and then mail it out. And now people can download those and print them themselves. So.
Mr. Erno, on the first slide on page 5, I was just trying to understand that chart, the revenue from new initiatives. It says $97.3 million in 2002-2003. 59.8 in 2004-05, and then 67.9 in 2006-07 target. Mm-hmm. Are you just being conservative in your estimates? I'm trying to figure out why your target would be smaller in 2006 and 2007 than when you had 210 in compliance dollars than in 2003.
Madam Chair, each one of these represents different types of initiatives. For example, the 97.3 in 2003 was just rolled forward and built into the state revenue stream. And we don't recount it. When we do the, and when we came to the 2004-05 biennium, that was a separately funded initiative that started anew. It started, and it was basically targeted to raise about $59 million. Actually, as of I believe October 1st, we were already up to $61 million, so we are exceeding it. And when we go to 2006-2007, the activity that's raising the $67 million is different than the activities that we had in 2002 and 2004. Those are rolled into the base and then get built into the revenue projections.
Not as cost-effective then, or?
No, they're cost-effective. We're continuing them, but they just get rolled in and counted as a part of the just revenue projections. They're not forecast separately.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could, just a footnote.
Commissioner Salamone.
Underscore, I think what I heard Dennis say, that the middle number is really an incomplete number. It is not a completed initiative.
Right.
And the out-year number is actually a projected return based on the proposal in the governor's budget to do another initiative.
Right. I just thought the target looked a little small compared to the...
To put that in perspective, Madam Chair, the first number, the $97 million, is the outcome of an issue which we initially estimated to bring in $60
million. Sure.
So it was more successful than we expected. Other initiatives will turn out to be better as well. We deliberately are conservative when we project the yield on these initiatives for various reasons. I can go into it if you want to take the time. But
no, that's what I assumed. I was just wanted to clarify that. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, you said there's a different initiative each year, and can you just give us your targeted initiative over the last couple of years and what you're projecting for the next initiative? What are you targeting? Corporation? Are you targeting individual? Are you targeting low-income individuals, high-income? What's your goal?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, in 2002-2003, our target was basically about $59.7 million. We actually, as a result of those and tracking those initiatives, and they were tracked, by the way, by the Legislative Auditor Office, we actually received $97 million, or we exceeded the target by about $30 million. Basically, it was a broad spectrum of tax enforcement activities. It was focused on delinquent taxpayers who had not been paying their obligations. It was focused in on income taxpayers, particularly non-filers. Gary McClure can talk about the non-filers. But the concentration was on non-filers. Right. And then it was on basically businesses who had activity in the state but were not filing either corporate tax returns or business tax returns. So it was a broad spectrum of compliance activities. And no one particular population was targeted, but within those broad populations, there was segments of non-compliance that we focused on.
And Madam Chair, so you're going to continue that same type of activities in the next round in a broad fashion with folks.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that's absolutely correct.
Madam Chair, as you roll the number that you collect into the base, does it become a little bit more difficult then? You've got a whole bunch of people in compliance already, and so my understanding is that there's, you know, less people out there that you can target. So does it become more difficult?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, it does become more difficult. However, we are in the process and have been in the process of really developing more robust data warehouses and better analytical tools to identify noncompliance. So while at the same time it's getting harder, we're getting better and better tools. at our disposal and more robust information, basically intelligent information, to basically identify that noncompliance. At the same time, the population doesn't stand still. We found out, and I think I've indicated this in the last hearing, according to an IRS survey, 2 years ago, 11% of the people felt it was okay to cheat on taxes. Today, 17% say it's okay to cheat on taxes. At the same time, there was another national poll just released last week where 15% of the population admitted to cheating on their tax return. Then we, as a result of increased competition overall in the business community, we were seeing more aggressive challenging of tax laws. So we've constantly got that going on as well. So we don't think right now that we reached the end where it's not productive to pursue noncompliance.
Mr. Arnau, I actually did like Representative Solberg's question, and I think you answered it for 2002, 2003. But I'm wondering for 2004, 05, and then 06, 07, you talked about different initiatives. Are you going after
there were different
additional groups, or
we just expanded what we were doing, Madam Chair. Just doing more of it. If you look at audits in general, they make up about less than 1% of the filers. And the only way you can detect really noncompliance is basically going out and examining someone's records or visiting their premises. So it is a labor-intensive process, and you never know basically what the compliance is until you have actually went out there and examined it. You could easily, as we did in the last several weeks, had a combination of two audits that resulted in actually the payments of $24 million. Mm-hmm. And you don't know when you're going to hit those until you actually go out and do them.
Commissioner Arnau, when you do find a non-complier, I'm wondering if you have any policy in place for repeat offenders to find out if the same people are doing it over and over again. In other words, if someone did not comply, decided not to pay their taxes on 02, 03, can you follow those people? Is there something that prevents you from following those people if you're only looking at 1%? Do you have to do it randomly? Or can you look at the same people to make sure that the same people that have offended in the past are now complying?
Madam Chair, there are some taxpayers who have a propensity to basically pay as little as they believe the law will permit. And they receive basically challenge, huh? Well, I mean, no, that's all of us, right, but I do understate it the minute I got it out of my mouth. But basically, if there's any ambiguity in the law, they will certainly interpret it to take it to their advantage, or they will not purposely under-comply and take a chance that they won't be audited. There are some that repeatedly do that and have to be regularly audited.
We
do have to. Our goal is, of course, to change behavior, and I want to identify their discrepancies, get them into compliance, and then make sure they continue to stay in compliance. That's our goal.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry I'm a little late this morning, but I have a timely question. I was talking to a CPA last night, told me about one of his clients. It was a bakery. And the department came in to do a sales tax audit on bakery goods. And the determination as to whether or not the bakery items were taxable or non-taxable depended upon whether or not there was silverware available. And we're talking about a bakery now. I believe they have several locations, and the amount of 3.5 years of sales tax compliance, $140,000. The CPA told me that this would likely put the bakery out of business. So, can you tell me how a the owner of a bakery or the folks selling these bakery goods are supposed to know the department's whim and wishes in terms of how you determine whether it's has sales tax or not sales tax based on whether there's silverware available. It's not apparently so convoluted that it's a situation where the determination isn't as to whether the silverware goes in the bag with your bagel, but if there is silverware available somewhere, then it's taxable. So if there was no silverware available, it wouldn't be taxable. So these are the types of things. I mean, I understand the struggle, but when you go out there and essentially put someone out of business because of your anal interpretation 3.5 years after the fact, what are we doing here, folks?
Do you have an opinion on this?
Wow. Mr. Erna?
Madam Chair, if I may, let me give you a high elevation response. And then Judy Nickham from our sales tax division, fortunately for us, is here. Welcome to the world of the sales tax, where fine distinctions
Commissioner, I've had sales tax audit in my business, so I understand what sales tax audits are. And I'm sure we can go on and on and on and on about, but when...
Well, excuse me, Representative, you better be careful because the chair will admonish you for not being on task.
Thank you for that, Representative Kahn. I'll try to keep Representative Krenke on task as well.
But Madam Chair and
Let's
Commissioner...
Let's try to keep this focused on the conversation at hand, Representative Krenke.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, what I'm concerned about here is the issue of quote-unquote compliance when you go out after the fact. The sales tax was never collected. So, again, you're talking about a business owner, a small business owner, who never collected the tax, who now, you know, you come in and zap them to the tune of $140,000 on a minor interpretation. We're not talking about use tax that somebody knew they should have paid but didn't pay. We're talking about sales tax on prepared foods, quote-unquote, that the bakery owner operator didn't know is it or isn't it, and then we get down to an interpretation, a very minute level interpretation. And Commissioner, I can't help but feel that the reason that we're doing this is because of the compliance. You know, we're going to book $90 million in compliance. So,
Madam Chair, Representative,
Commissioner Scalamani,
two quick points, and I'll pass it off to. Our expert here, Judy. We're talking about the difficult distinction between prepared foods and basically restaurant food and groceries. We exempt groceries, we tax restaurant food, and then there's this fine line between things you can buy at Panera or some neighborhood bakery and you can sit down and eat it right there. How is that different from a restaurant? Those are the things we struggle with. I think one of the questions you're raising is whether there was any communication to that bakery owner prior to us showing up. And we do rulings and notices to taxpayers. So now Judy can elaborate on what we may or may not have done with regard to this issue.
Ms. Mikan?
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is Judy Nickham. I'm with the Sales Tax Division. Madam Chair, Representative Krenke, as Commissioner Salamone was saying, this is a part of the definition of what prepared food is. It's one of the indications to determine whether or not an establishment is selling what would be taxable prepared food. Bakery is an area where when we first adopted the streamlined sales tax definitions, there was a lot of controversy, a lot of conversation about bakery products and legislation on that. Bakeries were here to testify on those kinds of things. Following the adoption of the rules that says basically if you are preparing food, one of the indicators are if you mix it or if you heat it in any way or if you provide eating utensils. Those are basically the three criteria for determining whether or not you've got prepared food, which is taxable. We did provide information in the law change notices. We have fact sheets that were sent out. We did work with the industry on these kinds of things, Minnesota Retailers Association, the Bakers Association, and information is available. Now, I can't answer to whether or not this particular bakery was given that information.
Madam Chair,
thank you, Representative Franke.
This is apparently getting down into the what is the definition of utensils provided. So, can you give me what are the department rules? In fact, apparently there are no department rules in terms of what utensils quote unquote provided means. Are there rules in the department for what utensils provided means?
Just that they need to be, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Cranky, just that they need to be made available to the customer, not that they're put in a bag or not that they're handed to them directly, but that they're made available to the customer. We have a revenue notice that we've issued that tries to define that for purposes of what a restaurant is, versus a convenience store. But there are no rules for that. That is true.
So, Madam Chair, how is the proprietor supposed to understand what provided means? Because this is a $140,000 question to this proprietor.
Ms. Nankin?
I don't have a real good answer for that other than to contact the department, read our publications, and determine whether or not they are providing utensils. Are they made available to their customers? Did they prepare the food? If bakery, they prepared the food, are they providing those utensils to their customers in the manner that a restaurant would provide them? Or convenience, a restaurant or perhaps a, you know, even a, an area in a mall where food services are provided. Those are taxable sales, too. And they aren't necessarily handing utensils to a customer.
Okay, thank you. I think we need to get back on track once again, Representative Cranky. We've got several slides to go through. Well, that is a fascinating question. We need to move on.
Great for the tax committee.
Should raise that to the check, that question to the tax chair.
I'll bring it up with the tax committee chairman.
Madam Chair, Representative Cranky, I would just add that the Department of Revenue is really not the final arbitrator, too, on the interpretations. I would suggest in this case that the taxpayer file an appeal and let that work its way through and work with the department to maybe mitigate some of the consequences there. So, you know, there is discretion in the agency as to basically the length of those assessments and such. So I would suggest that the taxpayer file appealing and use that as a vehicle to work with the agency. Our goal is not to put people out of business. And if we can find any way to work with them and sustain them in business and support them, we will do that. You have my promise on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cranky. Proceed, Commissioner.
We are going to page 6, and you will see at the top of page 6 a bar chart. And this shows the number of full-time equivalent employees in the agency since 1996. And you can see that that has...
Representative Goldberg.
Go ahead, finish your statement.
Okay. And the reason we use 96 as a base because that was the beginning year of the Minnesota procurement system in which we counted employees, consistently among all state agencies. And you can see that we now have today, in spite of all the compliance initiatives, about 150 less employees than we had in 1996.
Mr. Madam Chair, now my question.
Representative Solberg.
Do you have a breakdown of those that are in the office in St. Paul as opposed to outside of the office in other areas such as Ely?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, we do, and I don't have that with me right now, but we'd be happy to provide it. In St. Paul, though, I can just tell you quickly, we have approximately about 600 people in our headquarters.
And Madam Chair, how is that
Solberg.
That number in St. Paul
currently from it was in 1896.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I don't have those numbers with me, but I'd be happy to get those to you.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be interested in that because in 1996 was about the time we were making decisions on your new building, and over Representative Krinke's and mine and some other people that thought that there was additional cost to build the building in the capital area was about additional $30 million altogether from just a location a few miles away was excessive. What I'm interested in to know is now your space needs, or do you have extra space in that building, and should we be looking at other agencies being able to utilize some of that space? So I would like to know what your St. Paul complement was in 1996.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I can tell you right now we do have extra space in our building. We have about 28,000 square feet. We can house an agency of approximately 160 to 180 people. That space has been freed up as a result of, again, our migration away from paper to electronic transaction. We've freed up a lot of prime office space, and we're the Department of Administration is looking for tenants. And basically, we'd like to get another tenant in the agency, so basically we can get some share some services to help cope with our costs, such as HR services or technology kinds of services. And that, so each the two agencies, we can combine the support kinds of services for of the two agencies and just provide one more robust kind of support network.
Madam Chair, if you just look in St. Paul, that I think other agencies are renting an awful lot of space from the private market
correct.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
How aggressive are we in getting those an agency into our own building?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Arnold?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that we've been working with the Department of Administration. We're ready, and we're anxious to have somebody in there, but we can only move as fast as the Department of Administration will permit. So.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we should
Representative Solberg.
Light a little candle under somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair,
okay.
Representative Solberg, I...
Commissioner Salamone.
Edmund has been working on this over the last year, and I know they're looking at state agencies that are currently housed outside the Capitol complex in rented space. So they're on exactly that point, trying to get people in from private space into vacant public space.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Can proceed.
Madam Chair, I will go down to the bottom chart on page 6, and what this chart basically illustrates is that, and sometimes we lose sight of that when we talk about tax enforcement activities, that 80% of the dollars that are collected by the state come in by people either voluntarily complying with their tax obligations or through tax audit and enforcement activities. About 11% of the money is basically constitutes the tax gap, or that's money that should be paid but is not being paid by any means, either through voluntary compliance or tax enforcement activity.
Do you have a breakdown on that 11%? Is it from people that aren't paying their babysitter or paying tax on that? Or?
Madam Chair, we did bring us slides on both
Thank you.
Income tax gap and the sales tax gap. And, Madam Chair, I'm going to defer right now to Commissioner Salamone and to go through the tax gap here.
Mr. Salamone?
Madam Chair, there are a number of slides that break down this tax gap we talk about. We've done two tax gap studies. One was done for the income tax, the individual income tax. That was done based on filings for tax year 1999. And then separately, we did a sales tax gap study for tax year 2000. Now, these gap studies are basically an attempt on our part through statistical measures to determine what is the total potential of revenue out there to be collected, and then compare that to what we're actually collecting, and then try to learn as much as you can about the composition of the gap. With the individual income tax gap, if you'll turn to the second page, you'll see that the total gap is $604 million, and that's the 11% that Dennis mentioned. The $604 million is, again, the amount of money that we think is out there to be collected that we are not collecting in spite of our best efforts on tax compliance. It's sort of like the frontier, if you will, in terms of future compliance initiatives. It's that piece of the 604 that we're trying to get a bigger chunk of. You'll see on the pie chart that there's a yellow and purple slice showing, and that is the high-level breakdown between $479 million, which we think is from under-reporting. These are taxpayers who are filing, but they're just either overstating deductions or understating their income. The other little blue piece is the $124 million, which we estimate to be the amount of revenue not collected because of simply taxpayers not filing. They're more difficult to build because we have to figure out that they even exist. I mean, they're out there, and you know they're not anxious to reveal their existence to us. Under reporting, at least you've got some information. You can contact the taxpayer and try to understand what's going on. That's the high-level breakdown of the tax gap.
Mr. Salamone, I'm wondering, for the under-reporting, what kind of, and you know, forgive me, I'm a new member, new to the committee, what kind of criminal penalties fall in this section? I'm not familiar with the part of law. So if I just decided not to pay taxes on that little sale I made or something, if you found out about it, what would be the penalty for me in law?
Madam Chair, I don't have that data with me. Maybe Jerry would be more familiar with that.
Maybe you could visit with former Senator Wynn Borden. He could tell you what happened.
Okay. Mr. McClure?
Madam Chair, there's a variety of penalties, typically of civil penalties, that can add up, but there are criminal possibilities as well, depending on the extent of the fraud and underreporting.
Do you happen to know this? I can check with staff, too. I'd like to look at the statute on that. Do you have that?
I don't recall off the top of my head.
Maybe okay. One of those orange jumpsuits, Madam Chair.
I look good in orange. No, I'm just kidding. Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Salamone, do you have any cross-checks built into family court system? In other words, there's a lot of things show up on issues of support and maintenance where people aren't reporting income anywhere. And is there any system of cross-checking there so that you pick up a lot of those people?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, we do an awful lot of data matching with the federal and other, even other state agencies, I suspect. Now, again, this is a good question for Jerry. That's been what we've been focusing on, in fact. It's part of our initiative is to try to get better data. And Dennis mentioned data warehousing, try to collect information, build profiles. And someday, hopefully, we'll have some intelligent software where we might actually be able to predict the probability of someone not reporting or under-reporting and be able to look at that. Maybe, Jerry, you want to add it, whatever you can to that.
Madam Chair, Representative, as the Commissioner indicated, the bulk of the information we have comes from the IRS, from federal government. We also get information from counties as far as homesteads are concerned, license holders. We do not get information from the family courts specifically.
Maybe you should look into that.
Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple quick questions, perhaps for the Commissioner. Obviously, you don't have as many resources, in your opinion, as you need to close this tax gap, and I'm wondering what the department's philosophy is in allocating enforcement resources. Do you go for the low-hanging fruit? Do you look for patterns of noncompliance and go for the most noncompliance or the biggest fruit on the tree, if you will? Can you share sort of the thinking and the philosophy in allocating enforcement resources with and perhaps not reviewing your proprietary information to potential scoff laws out there?
Let me just answer that generally. I think it's a little bit of all of the above. You mentioned a number of things, and we have had, in recent history, we focused on taxpayers furthest from compliance. Now, it may be that that group could be the least likely to pay, or their amounts may be, you know, they may not be low-hanging fruit. So I think it's sort of a portfolio strategies that we use, again, I'll defer to Jerry on the details. I just want to make one point, though, that when we talk about this tax gap, 604, we have no norm for that number. We don't know if that's a big number or a small number, because no other state has done a gap study, to my knowledge. I wish all of them had, and then we would know if we have a real problem. Of course, they would all use different methodologies, so maybe they wouldn't be comparable anyway, but I don't want to leave the impression that this stuff is just out there and all we got to do is a few smart things and we'll get that 604. We don't know. We don't know. And as we go deeper into it, I suspect it'll be harder to get. Jerry, do you have anything to add?
Mr. McClure?
Madam Chairman, Representative, the low-hanging fruit, typically we try to catch on computer matches and not invest a lot of our human resources. It's the ones who are truly off the radar screen that we invest our human resources. For example, in a tax gap study, almost 50% of that $600 million tax gap comes from people with six-figure incomes. Approximately 50,000 people underreport, another 3,300 are non-filers. So that's where we invest our human resources to pursue those.
And Madam Chair, just a follow-up.
Senator Forrest, I wanted to remind the committee that we have several pages back and we're not going to have the Department of Revenue back again, so we need to...
Oh, I think they can come back anytime we call them. Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll be mindful of that. Curious about litigation. At some point, no doubt, you litigate with some of these folks, particularly people with the means to defend themselves with armies of attorneys. What is your relationship? I would imagine the Attorney General's office supplies the attorneys that you use. Do you have this situation again where they bill you, or how do you make arrangements with the Attorney General's office regarding litigation?
Mr. Salamone?
As I understand it, and what I've observed is the Attorney General has PAC staff, and they do our courtroom work, and they consult with us on cases. We have our own legal and appeals division, which does both appeals and legal work. But the actual courtroom work is done by the AG, and I'm assuming we must pay some amount for that.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Arano.
We do, and within the Department of Revenue, we have an appeals unit that actually examines the appeals and then acts on the appeals. This is sort of a precursor before anything goes to court. And we can either reject or accept those appeals or compromise during that time. If the taxpayer decides to appeal our decision and go to court, they have a choice, depending on the dollar amount of the dispute, to go to small claims court or go to the full tax court. If they go to small claims court, our employees argue those cases. We're only represented in the full claims tax court or in an appellate court by the AG's office.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ron, I was just curious.
Your
relationship with the AG's office, do they bill you by the hour or do you have a retainer relationship? That's what I'm interested in.
Dan Austin here from Financial Management, but basically we pay them a fixed amount unless they bring in expert testimony.
Okay.
Then we have to pay for that in addition. But no, we're paying for basically 4 to 5 positions there. That's not enough for basically the litigation that's going on today, but it's a fixed amount.
Mr. Ostick?
Yeah, that's great. That answers my question, Madam Chair.
I just wanted Mr. Ostick to confirm that. Okay. I can be wrong.
Madam Chair, Representative, the general fund portion that they bill us is exempted. We do not have to pay it out of our ongoing funds. So it's picked up somewhere in the general fund. Ellen, you'd probably know more than I would about that.
Yeah.
If we have something with the highway user fund or some other fund, we pick that up out of our operating costs.
Madam Chair, just a comment a task for Mr. Shepard. I'm going back a little bit to the large amount of vacant space that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know, I know for a fact, Mr. Shepard, that the state colleges and universities leases no less than 3 floors at the former World Trade Center, which is Wells Fargo Place, and the Attorney General's office has space across the street. I would like to know what the lease rates are and when that lease expires. It just seems to me rather inconsistent and inefficient that we would have space that the taxpayers have already paid for available in a rather nice building the times I've been in there, but at the same time we're paying lease rates, market rates to private companies, and I'd just like to have some information to help this committee perhaps craft some legislation that may help us use our space more efficiently.
Okay, thank you. I think Representative Mallory had a quick question before we get back into the presentation.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm trying to figure out what part of this gap, and are we looking at everything that would be available to us if everybody complied with everything, or are we looking at realistic things? I guess what I'm talking about is, I don't know if the chair knows, but if the chair ever picked up 2 McDonald's cheeseburgers and...
If the chair does not like the McDonald's cheeseburgers.
Well, if it for somebody else. and picked them up in Maple Grove and came over here and ate them, there'd be supposed to be a use tax form sent in and a one penny sales tax to St. Paul paid. This would be ridiculous for us to be trying. So I guess what I'm getting at is, what type of... Does this include everything like that that could possibly be under our tax system, or are we? Is it more aimed at what's realistic or something, what we would really want to go after?
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, first of all, this is just the individual income tax. We do have the sales tax, which we may not get to today.
Well, I had been looking at...
So there's you see both of them there on that first slide.
I was looking at the sales and use tax on the first slide.
Again, the general description of this is that it is what we would expect to collect, given what we know about the economy, information from the Census Bureau, tax filings, our own filing records. We try to estimate globally what we might expect to get, and then we sort of back into the tax gap number by subtracting off what we collect. There's a whole report we can provide you with the methodology. But it's really, I don't want to say a fictitious number, it's an estimate, a very difficult estimate to make that we, and maybe that's why no other state tries to do this, we try to just put the outer bound on what we might expect to collect, given relationships between personal income and GDP and things like that. And then we sort of back into it. It doesn't get as specific as what you're talking about in terms of the hamburger example. But in the case of the sales tax, we do break out use tax versus sales tax. We make estimates of that. We break out business versus individuals. There are some cuts that we can make, but they're all estimates, and as best we can make them.
Representative Mullery, did you want that report, or is that answer
Madam
sufficient?
Chair, I'll go in to try and get this later.
Okay, thank you. Can you continue with the presentation? And I know we've only got
quickly,
a few minutes left.
Madam Chair, just hit the highlights so that you know what you have. I talked about the pie chart. I'm on page 2. You can see the breakdown of the income tax gap between wage income at $68 million and non-wage income. Clearly, our biggest challenge is non-wage income, and that's intuitive. I mean, if you have people who are earning non-wage income, we don't necessarily get documentation about what they're being paid.
Mr. Salamone, I hate to interrupt you, but are you working from the income tax brochure?
Yes.
I think just in the shortness of time we have, and okay. I'm not sure if the chair isn't here today, I'm not sure if we will be able to get you in here again before we do our budget. I'm wondering if you could lay this over for now and revert back to the original
presentation,
if you wouldn't mind.
That'd be fine, Madam
and
Chair.
I apologize for that.
Dennis can pick up where he left off.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will revert back to budget. Before we leave the tax gap, I just wanted to mention one thing about it. One, those are just snapshots and moments of time. For the income tax, that was 1999. For the sales tax, that was the year 2000. The thing with the sales tax gap is it's estimated to be about $451 million in 2000, but by 2007 that will grow to $700 million. And the reason for that is, and I just wanted not to get lost, to go to $700 million is just because of the explosive growth in sales over the internet and catalog sales and purchases outside of the state. And that represents a real big problem for all state governments everywhere, and we've got to work collaboratively together to basically get the collection of those taxes, sales taxes by the internet companies and catalog companies, rather than putting the onus on the consumer to pay those once they're shipped into the state. And that would be a big revenue gain once we're able to solve that problem. Back to the presentation itself. I'm going to shift to page 7. And what are our strategies basically for coping with the budget reductions? We do have a $6 million reduction
embedded into our biannual budget proposal. The first thing we did is, of course, avoid reductions in activities that have a direct impact on the state collection of revenues. That's our tax enforcement activities, our criminal investigation activities, and our collection activities. Our cuts are primarily investments in technology development and infrastructure. This is going to basically delay or postpone our replacement of outdated equipment, or it's going to forestall the development, a more aggressive development of self-service systems. And, of course, we're going to reduce our rents for office facilities located in our main building. We see that as a good strategy to more aggressively manage our space more effectively. And then, of course, make room for other agencies that are renting outside the agency. There is new funding recommendation proposed by the governor. For the biennium, that's 13.7, and the expectation is that as a result of those new stepped-up enforcement activities, we will bring in $67.9 million. And we will track that separately, that production separately, for the people that are hired under that initiative and report back regularly to the legislature to ensure that those dollars are raised. Going to the page 8, in terms of our operating environment, we just thought we would list out some of the issues that we're coping with. Of course, we have the growth of the digital economy, and we have an obligation to try to keep pace where our customers are and provide the kinds of services that they use in their daily interstate commerce. We have the shift, of course, from the local economy to the globalization of commerce, where we had sales primarily made at a premise here in Minnesota. Those sales are now can occur anywhere throughout the world. We have demographic changes. We have an aging workforce. And, of course, we're serving a much more diverse population than we ever served. Matter of fact, for the first time, we now have our income tax instructions in Spanish and our sales tax registration in Spanish as well. And we're expanding that to other languages. We have increasing resistance to taxation and growing noncompliance. And, of course, we mentioned earlier here as we increasing complexity of the tax laws, and the least of not which is which we be conforming to the federal laws. I do have a handout that I would just encourage you to read separately. It's published by the Council of State Governments, and it's called the 10 Change Drivers for the Future. And that identifies four state governments, the mega changes that are happening out here and how they really affect state governments and, to some extent, departments of revenue. And they talk also about the erosion of our tax system as a result of these trends. Our key issues, I'll just highlight them very, very quickly. Of course, where we're focused in on is, one, improving tax compliance. Secondly, modernizing the tax system. We are one of 43 states participating in the Streamline Sales Tax Project. We're continuing to develop self-service tools for both businesses and individuals, and I'm going to page 9 now. We're concentrating on dealing with the growth in delinquencies. This was a result, basically, of the crash in the dot-com society and the downturn in the economy. As the economy downturned, we're now seeing the delinquencies. We saw a spike up in tax delinquencies that we're trying to basically manage down, and the modernization of our computer systems. I'm still on page 9, and I'm going to the bottom slide. Other important challenges, of course, is technology support and data warehouses. The services or compliance support services, that has been diminished from 52% in 2002, and now it's 37%. That presents a challenge for us. Workforce issues. We have increased accounting
competition for accountants. That's a result of the Sarbanes-Oxley bill. Since July of 2004, one out of every two positions we filled became vacant. One out of every two positions we filled became vacant because of the heavy demand for accountants. We just can't compete in terms of compensation. We're trying to compete in other ways, for example, rewards and recognition systems, growth and learning opportunities in the organization, and rewards and recognition systems. But we're working with the Department of Employee Relations basically to address this problem.
Mr. Chairman, just very quick, do you ever hire somebody that is not an accountant but to have some kind of a schooling to bring your people in-house up to that level?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes. We look for basically for somebody with an accounting background. They do not have to have be a CPA, just an accounting degree. Then we will hire finance and business majors, and then lastly someone with either a minor or related field. And we compensate them differently as they, of course.
Representative Colbert?
My question is that you aggressively try to promote people from inside and get them trained inside the college credit and so forth.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, yes, we do. We need to make really inroads on solving that problem before we can go forward really and aggressively take on tax compliance initiatives. We also have an aging workforce. By 2010, which is just 5 years away, one out of every four of our employees will be gone. By 2015, that's 10 years away, one out of every two will be gone. And that's a pattern that other states are seeing as well. So we really basically have an aging workforce, and we're going to also have a shrinking workforce. The workforce today in the United States is about 73 million. That's projected as a result of the retirement of the boomers to go down to about 43 million. So there's just going to be a general work shortage worker shortage in the nation in the next 5 years, and it's going to be dramatic. And we'll have to cope with that as well. Going to the page 10, as we look at our operating environment, we've developed basically eight strategies. Those are identified on page 10. I won't go through those, but those are basically the strategies we have in place in our organization to really meet the challenges that confront us in the next 5 years. And on the last page, page 11, we've instituted a number of strategies to reduce our costs, and I have those measures listed there. The one I repeated regularly throughout this presentation was the migration from paper to electronic transactions, the development of self-service systems, adoption of a new low-cost telephone integrated system, reducing our space needs, consolidating technology forms and replacing outdated computers, and consolidation of work units.
Okay. Thank you.
Just very quickly, instead of going down the road of additional people to have tax conformity, has the department or administration ever thought of having some kind of a program of a tax amnesty day to get people to come forward, and your philosophy on that?
Commissioner Salamone?
Madam Chair, we talk a lot about that, mostly in a defensive mode. We don't like tax amnesty.
Well, I understand the reason why, but at the same time, is it cost effective?
We would prefer, we don't think so. You get it one shot and then it's gone. We think the tax compliance approach is a whole lot better. It's, as I like to say, it's a gift that keeps giving.
Well, Madam Chair, amnesty would also... I've been identify people, and that would be a gift that keeps giving too, would it not?
Well,
with no cost,
Mr. Chair, I suppose, Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, I think it would depend on exactly who we're talking about, but it's just The states that have done it have certainly got a short-term shot of additional revenue. I don't know about how permanent that was. It's really all about getting people into compliance and to keep them into compliance. And tax amnesty will do some of that, I suppose. But generally, we've been opposed to it. It's sort of demoralizing to the people in the department who spend their lifetime and their working hours trying to get people to comply with taxes and to see us waive penalties and waive tax amounts.
Well, not necessarily waive tax amount, but waive penalties, and we think, Madam Chair, sometimes people won't come forward because of the consequences of the penalties.
Madam Chair, that's certainly true. One concern we would have, and every state that does this should have, is that if you do this too often, you will condition taxpayers into not being compliant.
I'm sure I don't think we've done it too often in the state of Minnesota, because I don't think we've ever done it, have we?
Yes, we have. We've done it about, sure, no. It's about 10, 15 years ago. And we, as I recall, and I can give you the results of that. We'll
okay, that'd be interesting, though. Under Rudy Perpich, we'd be the ones, right. I think.
We feel that in Minnesota, we do a good job. And matter of fact, we've been recognized by Governing Magazine as one of four states that do an outstanding job in the area of tax compliance. I think tax amnesties work best where you've had where you didn't have tax compliance programs in place in the first place, and then you're starting them up and letting people know that they will be detected. We think we're going to get the people that are out of compliance. We're going to detect them and get them anyhow. And we don't need a amnesty program. However, some states have used selectively amnesty programs for certain segments of their population. They're very targeted, and we're looking at some of those right now.
Thank you. It's 10 after, so we're going to have to adjourn. Members, we have a full agenda tomorrow, so please try to make every effort to get here. We also have the Secretary of State. With that, I will adjourn this meeting.